stomach batteries to power.
Now, everything old is new again. America's entertainment pop culture talk show.
It may well possess a rudimentary intelligence.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Felt a great disturbance in the force.
Hello, I'm Mr. Ray.
Come on, Mark, I got a job for me.
Where's the goodies?
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
I bet you wouldn't have done anything like this if Mom and Dad were here.
You filthy criminal.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Here are your hosts, Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
Welcome.
No!
Where am I? I don't know where I am.
You killed the Witch of the East. She has sisters in the West, in the North. Follow the brick road to the Emerald City. The wizard is there.
Can this wizard take me home?
Welcome to Everything Old is New Again. This is Douglas Viviani with the wizard himself, David Cohen.
Oh, great to be here, Doug.
I'm excited. This weekend we have a special guest. What you just heard was a clip, if you didn't recognize it, from a little bit of the intro to Emerald City, which is the new NBC show that's premiered, four weeks ago on NBC at Friday nights at 9 o'clock. We're excited about this series and have a rather interesting guest for us, David Cohen. Let's hear who we have.
We have David Schulner, who serves as the executive producer and writer on Emerald City. David's many other credits include other TV series like Once and Again, Desperate Housewives, Everwood, Kings, Tell Me You Love Me, and Do No Harm. And we're really excited to have David on the show. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
First and foremost, we all know, of course, the name Emerald City. We've heard that somewhere. If we rack our brains, we've seen a movie some people may have heard of called The Wizard of Oz. So what's the connection between maybe the books, The Wizard of Oz movie that we're familiar with, and now something called Emerald City for those who haven't seen it yet?
Sure. And we've only aired our third episode, but our second night, on Friday the 13th, January 13th. There's still time to catch up, and you haven't missed too much yet. So you can go to the NBC website or get the NBC app and catch up on those episodes.
Yes, and pull it up on demand. You can kind of binge it, which I suggest is not a bad idea because there are quite a number of new and interesting takes on these characters. So what we're saying is Emerald City is, I believe you'd say, is a new take or a different take on the original story, the first book, I think, of L. Frank Baum's Wizard of Oz. Is that correct?
Well, what we've done is we've taken, so Baum wrote 14 books based in Oz. And the second book doesn't even have Dorothy in it. The second book is strictly Jack Pumpkinhead and Mombi and Tip, and there's no Dorothy, Lion, Tin Man, Toto, anything. So what we've done is we've taken all 14 books, taken all those characters, and kind of put them all together in the same world. As opposed to telling the story chapter by chapter, we kind of mix it all up. So what you're seeing when you watch Emerald City is a combination of 14 books, hundreds of characters from all those books, all inhabiting the same world at the same time.
And David, this is a very light and happy take on The Wizard of Oz.
Well, you know, we've been getting a lot of, I'll say flack for being so dark. But I think, one, we're telling an adult story. We're taking,
sure,
we're doing a contemporary adult version of these books. And when we're telling an adult story, I guess, you know, anything can be considered dark when you're comparing it to a children's book. But the other thing is, you know, the movie Wizard of Oz, which is only the first book, most people obviously remember the color and the songs, and Judy Garland. But I think what they forget is Wizard of Oz is usually rated as one of the top 10 scariest movies of all time. In those compilation lists, between The Wicked Witch of the West, the trees that grab you, the flying monkeys, the scarecrow being picked apart by the crow, you know, by the monkeys, and, you know, there's a lot of really terrifying things in Wizard of Oz. And, you know, when I was a kid, I think that was my takeaway, was actually how scary it was. And I think a lot of people forget that.
That's true, because it's overcome sometimes with the whimsical songs and the presentation of the characters in the way that Ray Bolger and all of them did. Just a little trivia there is going along the lines of what you just said. I had been researching this and found something interesting that back in the day in the 1939 when they were making this movie, the original movie, talk about being scary, the characters themselves, the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, and the Lion could not eat in the cafeteria with everyone else at MGM because they were too scary and didn't feel that, believe it or not, that was what it was. And so they had to eat in their own trailers.
That's awesome.
So that really is, just flash back to that time and day, those were characters that didn't, just themselves. Of course, you mentioned all the other wizards and the witches and everything else.
Did you have the same problem on the set for your show, David, or...?
No, we didn't. No, our problem was the catering. No one ate the food.
That was scary enough, right?
It was scary, yeah.
And also, there's we talk about that music, which kind of lightened, I think, the original movie up. You do have certainly have a soundtrack here. There's I don't want to give it away, but there are some. At least there's one song I know that's a song from a very popular band down the line in the series that you'll hear. The songs and music does play a part, but it's not a musical, of course. And that's important to acknowledge that this dives into interesting takes on, I guess you'd say, the possible backstories of these characters that really does make sense if you dive into this series and watch really what is the Scarecrow? Why is he, coming to life and all that? What is the Cowardly Lion and what made him cowardly and so forth? Does that make sense? Did you kind of dive into that and look into these characters and peel them apart to try to get a backstory that would be interesting?
Absolutely. I mean, in the children's books, obviously, Baum doesn't go into the psychological ramifications of a lot of the characters, but, in the book, the Tin Man, for instance, which is, was in love with a woman and who, was in love with a woman who, a wicked witch, not the Wicked Witch of the West, but another wicked witch, controlled. And every time the Tin Man would touch this woman he loved, the witch put a spell on him which made him chop off each of his limbs with his own axe. All right? This is the children's book.
Right.
So when people accuse us of being dark, I'm like, wait, go back to the Tin Man's story. He self-mutilated himself with his wood chopping axe and,
Yeah, I mean, Grimm's Fairy Tales does that, and all the, if you look at the Disneyization, if you will, of the Cinderella and all those stories, if you go to the original stories, they're pretty dark. The Little Mermaid actually dies in the end, and that becomes part of the sea again, and dies and all that. So, not to get too far astray, but yes, I mean, that is a good point.
Fairy tales are dark.
Yeah, and to teach a lesson to children, I guess you'd say. But now we're going to try to teach lessons, if that makes any sense, to adults in a way through this story. The question is, you mentioned Frank Pumpkinhead and some others. Are there some characters here that haven't revealed themselves as to actually who they are, but may, if you go into another season or two?
Well, I think we do. We pretty much reveal everyone in the first season. Dorothy finds the Scarecrow, or our version of the Scarecrow in episode one. People are going to see the Tin Man very soon. And then we're going to meet the Lion later on, down the Yellow Brick Road.
And we'll meet you one more second, David. We'll meet you right after this commercial break and we'll come right back.
You're listening to Everything Old is New Again, America's entertainment pop culture talk show with Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
Something tore through the sky.
There is talk of rebellion.
Of magic?
There's no more magic in Oz.
Find her. She doesn't come back to Emerald City.
By what magic did you kill my sister?
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Ah, that's eerie. This is Douglas Viviani back on Everything Old is New Again with David Cohen. And we are with David Schollner, the one of the executive producers, writers of Emerald City, which appears on your TV screen on Friday nights at 9 on NBC, and certainly can pull up on demand if you've missed a few episodes. Feel free to dive into that. David, welcome back. Glad to have you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Talking about and diving into a discussion, continuing a discussion of Emerald City. We spoke about the L. Frank Baum novels a bit. Just wanted to see, we were mentioning that there are some characters, a few, that you seem to have developed yourself. Now, let's be clear, the Wizard of Oz novels are in the public domain, so did that give you some avenue of freedom to take these characters and do with what you're doing with them? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, we had free reign of these books, and obviously we give L. Frank Baum credit in the show. And we want to do, and it's not just cherry picking, we want to do justice to the original intent of the book. So a lot of people think we're being very topical by having a character named Tip, spoiler alert, who at the end of the 2-hour premiere goes from being a boy and then he turns into a girl, and that's that character's journey through the rest of the season, is trying to come to terms with this new gender identity. And a lot of people think that we're being topical or we're trying to be political or so, you know, but this is from book number 2 in L. Frank Baum's Oz series. This is the character of Tip, who starts off as a boy and ends up a girl, and we are just taking this character from the book and putting her in the world. So
see,
it's not our agenda. This is straight from the book.
Right. So interesting, because L. Frank Baum was a very strong supporter of the independent woman back in his day. And we're talking about 1901, 1899, thereabouts,
yeah,
when he was developing the first novel. His mother-in-law was very big in the suffrage movement and so forth. So
one of the most famous suffragettes.
Yes, so it was very much on his mind, you can definitely say ahead of his time.
Absolutely.
I would also suggest that something you may be hearing is that this Dorothy character is not the sweet, innocent 16-year-old that's frolicking and skip-toeing to the tulip, so to speak. This is a strong woman that is trying to resolve her own problems or her problems herself as best she can, as opposed to in the movie, they kind of sanitize it. I think you could say that these other characters helped, if not did, solve her problems for her. Does that make sense? It looks like it's a different turn there.
I don't know. I always thought, Dorothy was the one who... the movie is owned by... We're not doing the movie because the movie is not public domain,
Right.
And the book is actually Silver Slippers. But the movie was like, well, we're doing Technicolor here. Let's make them Ruby Slippers, So you're not going to see Ruby Slippers in our show because that's not the book. But going back to your point, I always thought Dorothy was super strong in the movie. If you remember, she's the one who went up to the lion and I think like punched him in the face or bopped him on the nose or
right.
Something. So I always thought Dorothy was this really strong character. And the only thing we're doing is fleshing out the moments and giving characters time to really... How would you feel if you were transported to a magical world and everything you knew and loved was gone in an instant? Most of us might not be as positive as Judy Garland's character was in the movie.
Right.
Or optimistic as Dorothy was in the books. So we're just going for, honestly, just a more realistic adult spin on this. So we're not trying to be edgy or dark. We're just trying to make it more realistic.
Okay, and that's what kind of the world we're living in now. We see a lot of that in our entertainment now, and obviously is attractive to people to revisit and see these characters that we think we know. But if you read, if you read these novels, you really, there was a certain interpretation back then, and now this is what we're trying to say here. I think is it's maybe a little more faithful interpretation of the original intent of the stories. No.
I would hope so. I mean, in the second book, an army, the whole, besides being about Tip and Mombi, this woman, this boy who wakes up a girl, the other plot line is about all the women, all the young girls of Oz, become an army and march on Emerald City because they're tired of being ruled by men. And their goal is to dethrone the king and put a queen on the throne. This is the second book of the series in 1902 or 1903. We couldn't make this up.
Right. And there were some deficiencies back in the day. I mean, with men, I guess, is what we're trying to say was we all have issues. But back in that day, there are theories that if you take a look at the three characters, the main male characters, they have their own deficiencies that, that kind of, there are themes that presents a problem. And that's what Abbaum was trying to say is for the men inside, you have these, the courage and you have a heart. Recognize it and become and fulfill that. Hopefully the male species has done that this day, but who knows?
The most efficient character of them all was the wizard.
Right, exactly. And he was a big fraud, or was he? You know, that's the issue. We certainly can debate that. There's another theological or philosophical discussion I want to have with you, but first I want to play this one clip from a show we always do, a little bit of a Star Trek reference from Captain Picard here. Tune in.
This is one of those times when we must face the ramifications of the Prime Directive.
And that's referencing a Prime Directive in Star Trek. If you're not a fan or what have you, the bottom line is when they go out and meet new cultures, the people in Star Trek and the crew are restricted from interfering with the development of an existing society if it doesn't or hasn't reached a certain level of maturity. Now, if we look at this story and we see when the wizard has come to this location and Dorothy, from a different plane, a different existence, a different world, so to speak, and I'm not going to give anything away, I just want to ask the question, though, when that happens, does the wizard and or Dorothy affect the natural development of this world of, let's call it Oz, and in turn, is that fair, and is that, you think, what's happening? Did they violate the Prime Directive and cause problems here?
I think 100%. I think it happened, it happens in the book where the wizard, eventually in the books, the character of Tip outlaws magic because people have abused it, and it's creating chaos. We took that idea of magic creating chaos and running rampant, and we gave that idea to the wizard. So he comes in and he outlaws magic as a way to for him to gain in status and for him to remain unchallenged. But what he ends up doing is creating an underground kind of rebellion against him, which will be led by Glinda.
All right, we'll be back on Everything Old Is New Again to develop that theory a little bit further. And welcome back to David Schuller on Everything Old Is New Again.
And you can stop it.
You're listening to Everything Old Is New Again, America's entertainment pop culture talk show with Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
We're looking for a girl and her dog.
Nothing good comes from the sky, so when it does, we send it back in pieces.
There's only one person I fight for since the moment we met.
Welcome to Everything Old is New Again. That clip was from the new series on NBC, Friday nights, 9 o'clock, Emerald City. And we are happy to have the executive producer, writer, David Schulner, the sorcerer supreme, if you will, of all things Emerald City at this point. David, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
I have a quick question in terms of your participation in the show. Now, you are an executive producer and writer with some others. Let's just explore a little bit of what you're doing specifically on the show itself.
Sure. So me and Sean Cassidy are kind of the showrunners of the show. And we have three other writers. We have a phenomenal writer named Tracy Belomo, who has been with us on our staff. And then we did two freelance episodes, which used to be the rule of the day back in TV in the 50s and 60s. But it's kind of grown out of fashion, and we kind of brought it back a little bit. So what that means is we brought in writers for one episode and then sent them away to write their episode and then work with them on that one episode, as opposed to an ongoing weekly basis like Tracy, me, and Sean do week to week. And we brought in an amazing comic book writer named Kelly Sue DeConnick. If you haven't heard of her, check out her comic books on Image and Marvel. And then a phenomenal playwright named Naomi Izuka, who teaches playwriting at UCSD. So we brought these two writers in to kind of collaborate with us.
And what does that do with regard to the process? Do you think that brings some, a fresh look, some fresh blood into the, a fresh memory, energy into the process? Or why would you do that?
Absolutely. I think, very easily you could start drinking your own Kool-Aid, and it's really great to bring people in with a completely fresh perspective. And even though they were only responsible for one episode, they were able to look at where we were going and where we'd come from and kind of have ideas and thoughts that would help us kind of shed a little new light on stuff that we may have missed or shortchanged. So it's just great to bring in some fresh blood.
And just taking a look at your story a little bit, maybe you could just give us a little idea, because if you look at your career, it goes back all the way back to Desperate Housewives you were a writer on, and quite a number of shows you developed and were executive producer and writer on. How did you get into this business? What was the path you took? Because there's no real known path to it, if that makes any sense. You don't just go to college, graduate,
completely,
and become what you're doing. So how'd you do it?
I was a playwright. I started writing. I was lucky enough to go to these great performing arts schools in Miami, Florida, where I grew up. And I thought I wanted to be an actor. And our acting teacher came in and she said, "I'm really sorry. There's been a horrible mistake. I'm not an acting teacher. I'm a playwriting teacher." And they made a mistake and they've hired me to teach your class. So I'm not going to teach you acting. I'm going to teach you playwriting, and maybe that'll make you better actors. So by accident, I took a playwriting class when I was 16 and realized I wanted to be a playwright. And so I started writing plays, and that led to Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskovitz, who created 30-something and My So-Called Life. They read a play of mine, and they asked me to come write for their show Once and Again. And that was about 15 years ago.
Wow. And how did they get to this this play that you, or a couple of plays that you wrote? I mean, was that just a submission to everybody on the planet, or what?
No, well, here's how you do it. You go on a blind date with a writer from Dawson's Creek, and then you have a TV career.
That's what I've been telling you, Doug. Yeah, I've been telling you, go on the blind date with someone from Dawson's Creek. You won't listen to me, though.
There you go. Very specific. It's a very specific path. And then we traded plays, and she was a playwright too, and we traded plays, and she gave my play to her agent.
Now, you say you grew up, and this was in Miami or in Florida. The date itself, did you bring yourself to California first, or did you date her?
I did. I did. I had a theater company in Minneapolis for 4 years. And as someone who was born and raised in Miami, 4 years in Minneapolis was about enough for me. So I quickly moved to California, and was writing plays for South Coast Rep in Costa Mesa. So I didn't even live in Los Angeles, actually. I lived in Long Beach, and I worked in Costa Mesa. But then you get set up on a blind date with someone who writes for Dawson's Creek, and there's your career path.
All right, so we got to think about who I can date these days.
How long did that last, by the way, David?
I married her best friend. if that is any indication.
I guess it went pretty well then.
It went pretty good, yeah.
I wonder, did you use any of that experience to develop any storylines in Desperate Housewives or anywhere else? I mean, that sounds like a story unto itself right there, how that happened.
Too tame for Desperate Housewives.
Right. A story for another day. I guess G-Version is quite interesting, and we're talking with the executive producer, writer David Schulner from Emerald City, Friday nights at 9 o'clock on NBC. I find it interesting that when we're talking about this show, if you did not hear this interview and just went into this show blind, you know, we have, like it or not, the impression of Wizard of Oz. I don't know that many people have read even synopses of original 17 novels by
14.
There are a few that were published after he died, too, right? And then series after that, even. So everything at Old is New Again ourselves. We're going to go through the power of radio next show, and we're going to go back to Oz 78 years later and meet some of these characters ourselves. So you may want to tune into that next week. But along those lines, I think it's interesting if you take a look at the show and with an open mind and put aside your experience with the old movie and just take it front with a blank slate with some characters that you're familiar with but may not know the entire story. It's sort of like being in high school or college and knowing people in the hallway and having an impression of them but not really talking to them. But when you sit them down for a few minutes and talk to them, it opens up a much more colorful kaleidoscope of who they are. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what we haven't talked about yet is Tarsem, our director.
Yes.
Who brings just a complete otherworldly beauty to every scene he shoots. And Sean and I would both be remiss if we didn't include him in like our little triumvirate, because he took what we had on the page and he completely reimagined and made it better. And Tarsem directed all 10 of our episodes.
And if you look at what he developed, there's no view of the world of Oz like this. It's not just painted on backgrounds, you know. This is a real expansive view of this world, and I think it's real fun to look at down the alleys of Oz and see what people are doing for a living, or what are these monkeys really made of, and what's the purpose of these monkeys for real? Monkeys in quotes, right? And so I think, yeah, he did a great job, and I think now was that had to be on purpose to have, because many shows have many directors, to have one director present the entire first 10 episodes. What was your thinking on that? You needed some consistency or what?
Well, you know, we were just looking for a pilot director, and Tarsem was the one who came and said, I have no interest in directing one show. And then he said it'd be like someone sleeping with my wife. He said, why would I want to do all the hard work of creating this world, finding the locations, working with the set designer and the costume designer and the prop master, doing all the hard work and then giving the fun part, which is shooting, to somebody else? Hmm. So he said, the only way I'll do it is if I can do all 10.
Interesting.
And I was thrilled. I was like, oh, thank God, this is going to make my my life so much easier. And it's going to give the show this great consistency. But it's just not how it's done in TV.
But you can also see his enthusiasm for the show, and we'll get back in a moment, just cutting for a break here. We'll come on back, and Everything Old is New Again, and continue talking Emerald City with David Schulner. Friday nights at 9, NBC.
Now, back to America's entertainment pop culture talk show, Everything Old is New Again, with Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
I woke up in a place I don't belong.
Did you ask yourself why? You were brought to Oz? Are you just a girl from Kansas? Or are you more?
There's a darkness here. Something wicked.
And you can stop it.
Definitely not Kansas.
Welcome back to Everything Old is New Again. This is Douglas Viviani with the Sorcerer Supreme, David Schollner, executive producer and writer of Emerald City, which you can tune into on Friday nights at 9 o'clock on NBC. Of course, we're here with David Cohen as well, and we're having a pretty interesting discussion about this new series, Emerald City, which is a 10-episode series at this point, David. Are there any plans, do you think, for anything in the future with this? I mean, sounds like there's quite a bit of material if you felt like doing more.
Yeah, we got 14 books. Yeah, absolutely. If people watch it, if people like it, then we'll be back next year.
And if we have anything to say or do about that, we would join in on that and say, take a listen and a watch to this show. And even, if you've missed any at this point, you can go to On Demand and NBC and pick that up. To me, you could watch it once and go through it, and that's fine. But there's a lot of levels of things that are going on as the show develops over time that if I kind of binged it. I had the privilege of being able to do that. So for me, I was able to catch some things, and I actually went back and watched a few parts of different episodes to piece some things together that are happening. And if you're watching a show that's like this where you've got a week in between every episode, I would suggest it might not be a bad idea to go back on demand to just revisit the show again before the newest episode. Am I wrong? I mean, especially as it develops, there's a lot of themes and intermixing of what would you say, motivations between different characters that eventually comes to a climax at the end.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, especially in this day and age of live tweeting the show, which we've been doing, I can't imagine what Tarsem would think. People looking away from the screen for a second even just to tweet something about the show or good, bad, whatever, but you take your eye off the screen for a second and you might miss just an amazing, something you've never seen before on screen because of Tarsem. So that's one reason I would rewatch the show. I mean, I've seen each episode hundreds of times in the editing room, but sometimes I make connections from the just things that Tarsem's done that I see for the first time. And this is after hundreds of rewatching, even being on set, and I'm just floored by the visual beauty of the show, which I had nothing to do with. But as I can actually be a fan of the show because of what Tarsem did. And then, like you said, on a character level, yeah, there's a lot of things going on, especially because of the backstory with the wizard and the witches. Look, I hate exposition. I hate writing it. I hate watching it. So there's not a lot of exposition. You're kind of just dropped into this world like Dorothy is. So definitely, if you go back and rewatch it, you'll pick up bits and pieces of conversation between the wizard and the witches that reveal the history of Oz a little bit more.
And David, speaking of which, so tell us a little bit about how you became involved with this project from the beginning.
Sure. This has been this show is probably greenlit, I would say, or put in development about 4 years ago.
Huh.
Someone named Matthew Arnold had this great idea about putting all the characters in the books together for the first time. And with that version, that was picked up to series, a friend of mine named Josh Friedman came on to rewrite that script and become the showrunner for the show. Josh hired me to be one of the writers for the show, and we worked for about 4 months before NBC and Josh kind of couldn't come to a tonal agreement on the show, couldn't really crack what it wanted to be.
Hmm.
So then the project died, and then about 6 months later, NBC asked me to resurrect it, to come on board And then since I saw what happened between Josh and NBC, I kind of knew where the bodies were buried. I knew what NBC wanted, and I knew what Josh wanted, and I felt like I could bridge the gap, so to speak.
And did you have help at the time when they asked you to sort of re-engineer it?
No, I mean, I quickly took a stab at it just to see if I could do it, just to see if what I wanted to do would be okay with NBC as well. I didn't want to go down the same road Josh did. So I kind of made a few adjustments, and I repitched the show to NBC. And then as soon as they said yes, I brought in Sean Cassidy to run the show with me because I knew what a huge, huge undertaking the show would be.
Hmm. Now, just taking a look at this show, talking about everything old is new again, I think this topic is something that we're running across, and it's the reason why we developed the show, is that in entertainment, in the world in general, but in pop culture and entertainment, lots of our current entertainment relies upon the history and the foundation of shows and projects before. Doesn't mean it, and this is a great example, is a repeat or a copying or of anything in the past. This is a reimagining, and maybe, as we said, a more thoughtful respect, a more thoughtful presentation of the original story that are in the book. So, I don't know, do you think that this is ripe for everything old is new again in terms of that topic? I mean, we're on the same wavelength, I guess we could say, with the radio show here and what you're doing, I guess, no?
100%. I mean, what's great about your show and what's great about the topic that you guys tackle is, it was always thus. If you look at Shakespeare's plays were always based on someone else's plays or based on someone else. I mean, everything old is new again is not new.
Right.
in the best meaning of that. There are no new stories. All we can do is adapt our own mythology and our own stories for the day. And that's what the Greeks did, and that's what Shakespeare did, and that's what TV and pop culture is doing now. It's taking our modern myths and making them relevant.
And to extrapolate that, I accept the compliment of being in the same sentence as Shakespeare. I'm kidding when I say that. With the show. Along those lines, you know, if there's ever a time where you feel like doing an after show like they do with some of these shows, we're available to talk all things Emerald City. You see, that's a new craze, I guess, we see as well, right? To go into and you're saying you do this with the Twitter, right? When the show is on live,
right.
I don't know if you're explaining, but you're talking about the show. What's happening with the Twitter and how do you get involved?
So on Twitter, I mean, a lot of people ask, you know, on Twitter, like, oh my God, where did you build that castle? Did you go there? So I'll be talking about the locations where we filmed. You know, we filmed in three different countries. We filmed in Croatia, Spain, and Hungary. And, you know, dozens of cities in those countries. So I'll be tweeting about where this location was, or like last night, the other night, the character of Witch of the West gives this beautiful monologue about why she hates magic, how powerful she is, and how she's so glad the wizard banned magic. And it's this stunning monologue, and kind of Twitter blew up about, like, oh my God, this actress is amazing, and I tweeted that was her first take. That
wow.
Performance was the first time she did it, and that's what we used. And so I'll just tweet little things like that as we go. As we go throughout the show.
That's interesting. How would we get to the Twitter itself? How would we, you know, what's the hashtag or whatever?
We have the hashtag Emerald City.
Okay.
And there's the fan-supported hashtag Green With Envy, WIT, Green With Envy.
All right. And
fan-supported.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. We'll be back in a couple of seconds. But I wanted to thank you and tell you that we're really enjoying Emerald City. Friday nights, 9 o'clock, NBC.
Stop it.
Everything old is new again.
Warning.